Hello, everyone, and welcome to Linux Crazy Podcast. This is podcast number 84. Hope everybody's doing good. I've been feeling pretty good lately. I've been busy with my Gen 2 stuff. I enjoy it. I usually spend a few hours a day fooling around with it on IRC or testing something or trying to learn some more bash, reading the developer manual. So maybe one day I'll become a full-fledged developer. I had another review session with my recruiter, and as usually happens, I got confused and tripped up a little bit, only because the question that they were asking about Auto Tools build system, and I didn't really understand that. And I understand the Auto Tools build system a little bit, but really I'm not very proficient in it, so it was pretty easy for me to get tripped up. But my recruiter was very nice about it, and it's basically, it's not really a test, so to speak. I mean, it is a test to see, you know, what my knowledge is and to make sure that I'm not going to really mess up anything. But he's also very good about teaching along the way. So I, at first, when I was taking these, I guess you'd call them tests, but it's not really a test, but they call them sessions, I was really nervous because I was taking it like a test. So now I'm just going to try to relax and just take the session as a learning experience and not get all wrapped up in the being right and wrong and the testing part. I think what happens with me is just like with most things, when you get yourself all messed up over it, is fear is the bottom line. I had the fear about that I'm not very smart in this area, so naturally my fear comes out, and then once I get fearful, then my mind kind of locks up, and sometimes even questions that I know, I'm looking deeper, or I don't know exactly how to describe it, but I just kind of get locked up, and I can't answer the question correctly, and sometimes I know it. So, but I'm getting better. You would think by now that I would be able to do these tests, but like I said, it's not really a test. I got to look at it like it's not really a test. It's more of a learning session, and keep it like that so that I don't get myself all flustered over it. But it's definitely not easy. But, you know, it's just like anything else. If you face the fear head on and you keep prodding along, when you come out the other side, you know, you feel a lot better about it and you feel a lot more confident naturally. But you feel a lot more confident in your abilities, and your self-esteem increases, and it's just a nice way to do things. It's better than just quitting and saying, oh, to heck with it, I ain't going to do it because I feel like I'm a dummy. So I'm not going to be a quitter. I'm going to keep on prodding along and doing the best I can and learning along the way. That's the main thing about all this for me, is just to keep learning. So that's the fun part. Just keep it fun. Keep it like a learning experience, and don't get so wrapped up in the, like it's like a test. The other big news in the Gen 2 front is that Perl 5.12.2 is going stable. It's going stable as I speak on Friday, the October the 22nd. And I did it here on about three different boxes. I have two testing boxes and then my regular box that I went ahead and created a stable chroot, just to see how it would do on the AMD 64. And it did fine. And the other two x86 test boxes I have, they both did fine. Basically, with Gen 2, when you update Perl, go from one major version to the next, there's a script that you run. It's called Perl Cleaner. And this script reinstalls all the Perl modules that you had installed from the previous version of Perl. Everything has to get rebuilt against the new version of Perl. Now, if you've installed some Perl modules, I guess they're called Perl modules. See, I'm still in the Python world with modules. They're basically Perl scripts. I guess I'm not even sure if Perl calls them modules or not. But anyhow, if you don't rerun and reinstall all these Perl modules that have been installed with another version of Perl, then naturally you'll get all kind of weird errors and it won't work correctly. So you run this Perl Cleaner and then a space and a double dash all, and that rebuilds all your currently installed Perl modules to against the newer version of Perl, which is 5.12.2. Now, if you've installed some Perl modules on your own and you have them in some different places, now naturally you're going to have to go ahead and reinstall those on your own. The Perl Cleaner script does pick up some leftovers. I found that most of the leftovers that I had will be left over. Let's say the old version was 5.8.8, and Perl Cleaner script will tell you what files have been left over that it couldn't deal with that have been left over. I just make a mental note of what module that is. I just go ahead and delete those files, go ahead and reinstall the module if it's needed, and go on. A lot of times what's happening is, and I've noticed in Perl, is that one module that you'll install from CPAN, a newer version may include different Perl modules all encompassing in one module, so these older individual modules aren't needed anymore, so it's basically just leftover stuff. So went without a hitch. I have a couple people in Gen 2 that's really instrumental in getting this going. The main person was Tove, which is, by the way, my mentor for this becoming a full-fledged developer. And he saw the need that Perl was a little bit behind schedule, so he jumped in there and has been working on it for a few years now. And boy, now it's really come full circle, as far as instead of everybody laughing about Gen 2 and Perl being 5.8.8, now our stable Perl is 5.12.2. So a lot of times people will criticize Gen 2 that, you know, certain programs stable or old and this and that. And with Perl, it was truthful, because 5.8.8 was an older version of Perl. They can't talk about us and Perl anymore. What happens is you have, like, the Perl herd. At one time, it was real strong. There was a lot of people that are interested in Perl that were, you know, keeping it going. And what happens is they move on, or they get jobs that they don't have time to devote to Gen 2 anymore. And the project will kind of become stale, basically because there's just nobody there working on it. Gen 2 still needs somebody that's, you know, really involved with Perl to go ahead and jump in and become a developer. There's one fellow, Kent, that has been working really closely with Tove on a lot of the Perl stuff. And everyone, well, I don't know everyone, but me for sure, and Tove for sure, and a lot of other developers are hoping that he'll just go ahead and bite the bullet and go ahead and take his quizzes and go ahead and become a full-fledged developer. It's a big commitment. You know, this is all volunteer. You're not getting paid for it. And once you make the commitment, then, you know, you want to, you know, keep it up. But what I try to tell people when they say, well, you know, I don't have that much time, is everybody can do a little part. And then, you know, if you got 20 people pulling a cart, then, you know, the cart ain't too heavy. But if just one person's trying to pull the cart, you know, that one cart can be pretty heavy. So even if you only have time to do a little bit, then that's better than not doing anything at all. So just I would love to see him go ahead and just join up and just do what he can to help out, because he's a real pro programmer, full-fledged pro programmer. In fact, he does modules on CPAN. So, you know, he knows what he's doing, and he knows what's needed as far as the Perl herd is concerned. He's done a lot of work with Perl to get it up to snuff for Gen 2. I think the main reason he did that was just to help out. And he saw a need, he jumped in and did it. I try to help out, but I can basically just help out in Bugzilla, try to close some bugs, try to do some the legwork, you know, do a little research, do some legwork, stuff like that. Since I can't program in Perl at all, there's no way I'm going to be able to do any extensive Perl testing. So I'm not really cut out for being on a Perl herd, but I can, as a user, I can certainly help out in other ways. So that's what I try to do. What else has been going on? I had lunch the other day with a gentleman that owns a business here close by my house. It's such a small world. I was looking on Craigslist, which here in South Florida, and I think different places over the United States, especially the bigger cities, Craigslist is a place where it's free to put advertisements on. So in one of these advertisements, I was looking. I'm always looking at computer stuff and motorcycles and different stuff, seeing if I get something cheap or just seeing what the trend is. And with computer jobs or programming jobs or, you know, IT jobs, just to see what the trend is and maybe see if I can get a little side work out of it. So I happened to see this ad for this D-Rose Technologies. And when I looked at the website, it was said there that he preferred to work with Linux. They're a Linux shop. Everybody needs to know Linux. I was like, whoa. And then I looked to see where it was, and darn if it wasn't right down the street from where I live. It's not far at all. So I sent him an email and told him my background and that I was, you know, involved in Linux and this and that and involved with Gentoo. And we had lunch. And it was very interesting to get the perspective of a business person trying to use Linux and also to use the tools from Linux to actually make a living. So I have lined him up for an interview, and hopefully we'll be able to put that together in the next couple of weeks. But his name is Chris DeRose. He's 28 years old. He's pretty much done all this, you know, on his own. He started the business on his own and everything. He's actually a real-life programmer, naturally, but one of his specialties is Ruby on Rails. And he does PHP. He does, you know, a little bit of everything. He said he started out as a kid at 7 years old programming in BASIC, just doing games, and from there it went on and on and on. And he's a very, very smart fellow, and like I said, hopefully here shortly in the next couple of weeks we'll have an interview with Chris. The other thing that is pretty interesting that I ran across, which I'm sure most seasoned Linux users already know about, but I, for some reason, it had slipped my radar, was a tool called rsnapshot. Now, rsnapshot is a file system backup utility based on rsync. rsync with snapshots, the idea of using replication to create a snapshot-like system was popularized by Mike Rubel in an online article about rsync with snapshots. And I'll put a link to the article on linuxcrazy.com. Now, any of these links that I talk about in the podcast, you can go to linuxcrazy.com, and this will be podcast number 84, and I'll have all the links there that you can check them out. The idea of this rsync with snapshots is both simple and powerful. You first have to copy one directory to another directory. To do this, copy the source directory to a target directory, copy, space, dash A, space, /home/backups/home.o. Now, the O is important. It's actually a zero. And that's how you number your snapshots. Because you will need them later, the target directory must support hard links. Now, hard links are an important Unix concept to understand. If you're going to use this technique, every object in a Unix file system, which includes every directory, symbolic link, name pipe, and device node, is identified by a unique positive integer known as an endnode number. An endnode keeps track of such mundane details as what kind of object it is, where its data lives, when it was last updated, and who has permission to access it. If you use ls to list files, you can see endnode numbers by adding the I flag. So you would do ls space dash I space foo. So that's ls space dash I space foo. So is in this example, the number created is 409736, and then it'll say space, then foo naturally. What does foo consist of? It consists of an end node, specifically end node number 409736, and some data. Also, and this is the critical part, there is now a record of the new end node in the directory where foo resides. It now lists the name foo next to the number 409736. That last part, the entry of the name and the end node number in the parent directory, constitutes a hard link. Most ordinary files are referenced by only one hard link, but it is possible for an end node to be referenced more than once. End nodes also keep count of the number of hard links pointing to them. The ls space dash l command has a column showing you how many links a given file has. The number to the left of the file's owner's user's ID is the number of hard links, one in the following example. So in our little example here, it'll show dash rw dash r dash dash r dash dash space and a one. So the number to the left of the file owner's user's ID is the number of hard links. So it shows you how many hard links it has. To make a second hard link to a file within a file system, you use the link command, ln command. For example, link foo bar. So that would be ln space foo space bar. So then if you do the same thing again, ls space dash I space foo space bar, you'll see the two end node numbers to the left, and it'll be the same end node number, 409736 space foo, and then 409736 space bat. And if you run that command again, ls space dash l space foo, you're going to see two by that number. So it's changed from one to two hard links. The situation would have been the same if you remove foo and run ls list on bar itself. If you now remove foo, the link count drops to zero, and the operating system releases end node number 409736. Here is a summary of some of the important properties of hard links. If foo and bar are hard links to the same end node, changes to foo immediately affect bar and vice versa. Changes to the metadata of foo, the permissions, ownership, or timestamps affect those of bar as well as vice versa. The contents of the file are stored only once. The link command, ln command, does not appreciably increase disk usage. To get started using rsync with this snapshot method, you first have to copy one directory to another directory. To do this, copy the source directory to a target directory. So you would just basically copy space dash a, and you just copy from home to backups to home.0. Because you will need them later, the target directory must support hard links. Next, you need to make another copy of the data you backed up. This copy is used as the previous version when you update this version. To do this, copy the target directory and then add the .1 at the end of the copy, where 1 is another digit. So you just keep going, like it starts out a .0, then it goes to .1, then it goes to .2, then it goes to .3, etc. If you do this using hard links, the second copy won't take up any space. So use the dash L option of copy to tell it to use hard links when it makes the copy. So you would do copy CP space dash A1. Now there are two identical copies of our source directory on our backup system that take up the size of only one copy. Now that you've copied the backup to another location, it's time to make another backup. To do this, identify any files in the source that are new or changed. Remove them in the target directory. If they're there, then copy them to the target directory. If it's an updated version of a file already in your target directory, it must be unlinked first. You can use the rsync command to do this all in one step. Rsync space dash dash delete space dash av. Then you, like I said, if we're copying home, it would be /home /dot/space /backups /home.o/. So what it's basically doing is it's putting all of your home directory in this home.o directory. By removing a file that is already in the backup directory, backups/home.o, you sever the hard link to the previous version, backups/home.1. But since you've used hard links, the previous version is still there in backups/home.1. And the newer version is in the current backup directory in backups/home.o. Okay, now that was just an example of the manual way that you would do something with this snapshot way of doing things. But now that's where our snapshot comes in. Since we've already have a program for it that's already designed for what we want to do, why in the world would we want to do it manually? So our snapshot is an open source backup and recovery tool based on the Mike Rubel's original concept. It is designed to take a great idea and make it more accessible to users and more useful for larger environments. Under the hood, our snapshot works in the same way as Mike Rubel's original scripts covered, but I was kind of talking about before, or I was trying to explain before. It uses hard links to conserve space and rsync to copy changes and break the hard links when necessary. Now, like I said, our snapshot is a file system backup utility based on rsync. Using our snapshot, it is possible to take snapshots of your file systems at different points in time. Using hard links, our snapshots creates the illusion of multiple full backups while only taking up the space of one full backup plus differences. When coupled with SSH, it is possible to take snapshots of remote file systems as well. Our snapshot is written in Perl, and it depends on our sync. Our snapshot is written with the lowest common denominator in mind. It only requires a minimum Perl version and our sync. As a result of this, it works pretty much on any Unix-like system. The configuration of our snapshot is pretty simple, really. Most of the heavy lifting is already done. What I did was I copied etc. rsnapshotconfig.default to etc. rsnapshotconfig. And basically the parameters are this. Snapshot root. That's where you want to store your snapshot. Now for me, I have another hard drive installed in my computer. And it's under mount backup. So here are snapshot root I put as mount backup.snapshots. All I'm backing up with our snapshot is my home directory. Now the next step is setting up a cron for this to run. Oh yeah, and one other thing, our snapshot comes with a tool to check your configuration to make sure that the syntax is okay. So you just run our snapshot config test, and that'll make sure that you haven't made any major blunders. And to test it, I went ahead and ran our snapshot space dash t space hourly. This tells our snapshot to simulate an hourly backup. It should print out the commands it will perform when it runs for real. And that way you can see exactly what's going to happen when you do your hourly backup. Now it'll do an hourly backup and a daily backup. For the cron tab, you have to set up your cron for this, then you run cron tab space dash e to set up your cron tab. And in the cron tab that I have set up, daily runs every 30 minutes before hourly. So this helps prevent race conditions where the daily would run try to run before the hourly job had finished. This same strategy should be extended so that a weekly entry would run before the daily and so on. But I'm only running an hourly cron and a daily cron. Cron tab I set up is just the one from the example here, and it seems to run just fine. So I'll put a link to this guide that I used. It's actually a PDF file if you want to check it out. It's really simple to set up. Anybody can set it up. You can back up your home directory, keep your home directory backed up, and it's going to do everything for you automatically, and you really don't even have to worry about it. Works fantastic. So that's pretty much about it. And that's really about all I had to do. It does all the heavy lifting for you. If you follow this, I'm going to put this PDF up on LinuxCrazy.com. If you follow this PDF document, you'll pretty much be able to back up your home directory and not even have to worry about it. So give it a shot if you need a backup option. And that's about it for me, everyone. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll see you next time. Bye.